Hello, who just joined? Do we have someone on the phone line?
Oh, I'm sorry, I was on mute. Barry Cobb joined.
Hi, Barry. Thanks for joining. We're just giving everyone a few minutes to get breakfast, and then we'll get started.
Great, thank you.
The ridiculously early IRTP meeting. Thanks to everybody who's managed to get out of their beds this morning and make it down here. Some of us are here physically, but maybe not mentally, but we'll try and work through that. And thanks to all of you who've dialed in and are on the Adobe Connect. Rika, could you do a roll call, please?
If I could, maybe the easiest if everyone just around the table quickly says their name.
Perfect.
So, Tim, if we can start, and then James has to run.
I'll talk slowly. Tim Ruiz with GoDaddy, and council liaison to the working group.
James Bladel, GoDaddy.
David Giza, ICANN, contractual compliance.
Steve Gobin, ICANN registrar liaison.
Stacy Burnett. Contractual compliance, ICANN.
Pam Little, contractual compliance, ICANN.
Margie Milam, policy staff, ICANN.
Marika Kogonings, policy staff, ICANN.
Michaela Nalen, Black Knight, registrar.
Eric Brown, New Star.
Glenn de Saint-Gerie, the GNSS secretariat.
Olaf Nordling, ICANN staff, and a ghost of PDP's past.
Helen Laverty, Dot Alliance, registrar.
Liz Gaster, ICANN policy staff.
Eric Brenner Williams, CORE.
Amanda Webriel, CORE.
And I believe we have Barry Cobb and Chris Chaplow on the Adobe Connect. Is anybody else dialed in on the phone? No.
But they are on the phone.
Okay, so that's it. All right, good morning, everybody. This morning, we're going to have a wonderfully fascinating overview of the domain, the transfer dispute resolution process given to us by Eric Brown from Newstar. And then we're going to move on to a few other issues, but I'm going to pass it over to Eric now immediately. Thanks.
Morning, everybody. It's an early morning to be going through this, but I'll give it my best shot. I'm not a policy expert by any means. I'm actually an operations person at Newstar, so this is not my forte, but I'll give it a shot here. And for those who know the policy much better, if I misstate something or leave something out, feel free to jump in. I made an attempt to just kind of condense down the policy and hit the highlights. I encourage everybody to go and look at the policy online to get all the details. Oops. So the transfer dispute resolution policy offers registrars two steps that they can take. The first one's called a level one step, which is filing a dispute with the registry operator. And this can be done, well, obviously done as a first step, or they can go to a level two dispute filing process, which can be done either as a first step or as an appeal to the first level one filing. If they go to the level two as an initial step, they cannot go back to a level one. So often and registrars here can speak for this, they'll often go to a level one first and a level two as an appeal process, but they may, of course, go to a dispute resolution panel as a first step. And also, it should be noted that neither option prevents a registrar from filing a complaint with a court. So some of the general requirements for filing a dispute. A dispute can be filed by either the gaining registrar or the registrar of record, depending on which way the transfer, alleged transfer violation has occurred, whether it's a transfer out to another registrar that should not have happened or a denial of a transfer. The request is called a request for enforcement and I've abbreviated it here, called an RFE. The RFE needs to be submitted electronically to the registry and to the respondent, and the respondent is the non-filing registrar. It must be submitted within 6 months of the alleged violation, and the alleged violation date is either the date of a disputed transfer or the date of a NAC in the case of a denied transfer. The RFE must contain certain information, which essentially boils down to information about the domain registrant, the circumstances of the transfer, the remedy being sought, basically the details of the transfer and the domain record. The RFE may include more than one domain as long as the transfer incident is related. Each domain is part of the same group that were either denied or transferred in violation or allegedly in violation. The RFE must also comply with the supplemental rules established by the registry or dispute provider, and the supplemental rules include things like the fees for filing, the filing instructions, page limits on the responses, and any other kind of administrative guidelines. For a level one, there are no fees collected at the time of the filing. The fees are collected once a ruling is made. For a level two, the dispute panel may collect fees up front and then upon the decision determine who actually has to pay the fee.
Sir, just one question.
Yep.
Well, how much are the fees?
The fees are set by the registry, at least in the case of a level one. I'm not too familiar with how that's done with a level two filing, but I think in the case of Newstar, I should know this, but I don't. I think it's about $50, and I'll actually go on the record right now and say we've actually never had a dispute filed with Newstar in the 4 or 5 years since this policy has been in place, which is one of the reasons I'm not that familiar with the process. So the non-prevailing registrar ultimately is assessed the fee, and that could be the registrar that transferred the name in violation or the registrar that NAC'd the name in violation. And if a no decision is rendered, the filing registrar is assessed the fee. And then one last note is the fees are not to be passed on to the registrant. So some of the gaining registrar requirements are completed form of authorization, which is a whole different issue, and I think some of the registrars are probably much more familiar with the details of that form. Copy of the who is output at the time of the transfer, copy of evidence of identity use, copy of the bilateral agreements, with the registrant or possibly a court, copy of communications with the registrar of record related to the transfer, essentially all the background information. Registrar of record requirements are similar, but slightly different. Completed FOA, copy of the who is output, the relevant history of who is modifications, and evidence related to one of the permitted reasons for denying a transfer request. I didn't list them all here, but I think most people are familiar with them. They're, fraud, UDRP, under a UDRP dispute, and so forth. There's a list of permitted reasons to NAC a transfer. And then also, again, copy of communications with the gaining registrar. This is a timeline workflow of all the steps that go into this process. It's kind of hard to see, I think, up there, and I'll go through it here. This was actually provided to me by Barbara. It was very nice to put this together. So the RFE can be filed within 6 months of an alleged violation. The response by the non-filing registrar has 7 days to respond to the complaint, and that can be extended for an optional 5 days if at the discretion of the registry. And sorry, I'm going through the level one dispute resolution process. And then once the response has been received, the registry operator has, I think it's 14 calendar days to review the facts and make a decision. And the registry operator can make a decision of no decision if they cannot determine whether the transfer was done within policy or not. And then there is an appeal period of 14 days as well from the from the losing registrar who can appeal the decision. And then within that 14 days, so the decision is rendered by the registry operator, and the enforcement, whether it's to reverse the transfer or allow the transfer to stand, if it's a reversal, for example, the action is not taken until the end of the appeal period. And during that appeal period, the losing registrar can go to a level 2 dispute resolution provider or to a court of competent jurisdiction. A level 2 dispute resolution is very similar with some slightly different time frames, namely that the dispute resolution panel has 30 calendar days to review the facts and make a decision. And then again, there's an additional, I think it's a 10-day appeal period at the end of that. I think that's all my slides, actually. So there are, were there any questions? I mean, that's kind of the high level. The whole purpose of the dispute resolution policy was to try to create a lightweight mechanism for examining transfers that were either alleged to be done fraudulently or denied transfers, and providing a way to go to a registry to try to resolve the dispute without having to go through to a panel or a court, which is much more expensive.
Tim?
Yeah, just wondering if we had any information on how many level 2 disputes have been filed, that's available.
I don't have any information speaking for, you know, Neustar and .biz. I know we have had zero level 1 disputes filed with us in the 4 or 5 years. I can only guess as to why that is. I don't know. You know, Barbara's not here from VeriSign to give some statistics. They're obviously a much bigger registry and probably have, you know, see more of these. My guess is that has more to do with size. You know, we've been a thick registry longer. I think that's played into some of it. And, you know, registrars may have a better sense of why there are disputes in certain TLDs than others. You know, I'm assuming they're just more popular, you know.
James?
Yeah, thanks, Eric. This is a good overview. And I think that without remembering the exact number, Barbara's mentioned on the call, the numbers were very, very low as well. So this is not a particularly, what do I want to say, popular or widely adopted or widely used policy. And one of the reasons, I think, is because registrars, in the event of a dispute, their first inclination is to work with one another and to view this as an escalation path. So the TDRP itself is, it contains escalations, but it is in it itself an escalation.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's a good point, that most registrars work it out before it ever gets to this point.
So I had one question. Is in relation to the court, was it the Court of Competence?
Competent.
Yeah, what does that mean in English for those
competent
who don't
jurisdiction?
Speak legal?
I'm not a lawyer, so I won't give you a good answer, but it's basically a court of jurisdiction that, you know, it might be where the registrar's, their RRA is with the registrant agreement, whatever court, you know, and jurisdiction that the registrar is in. But I'm not the right lawyer to give you that answer, but it's the correct court that you would go to for the file. There's probably some lawyer here who could answer that question.
Yeah, no, that's a good explanation. It's basically the appropriate court that's usually where the registrar is located, but there's rules on that.
But which registrar? The losing or the gaining?
I guess it depends on who's bringing the claim. I don't know the answer to that, but.
Sorry, just a question. Okay, Barry Cobb, who's on the Adobe Connect.
Yes, hi, thank you. I wasn't really playing around in the domain space in 2004. Is there a quick statement as to what we were trying to fix when this policy was enacted? Just, and the reason why I ask is if it hasn't been, it's not very popular, because I liked that word, James, even that's what I was thinking of when you were kind of scrambling there, but you know, since it's not used very much, I'm just curious what we were actually trying to correct back in 2004.
Well, I wasn't involved in this in 2004. I was around, but I don't exactly recall all the circumstances. I know there was a review of the transfer process in general, and I think this was a part of the overall tightening down of transfer procedures. And it was, I think, designed to just provide a cheaper, more efficient escalation path as opposed to going to a court or a panel at all the time, you know, to give the registries an opportunity to act as an arbitrator. But maybe Tim or someone might recall.
There may be other reasons also, but I know one concern some registrars had was just that, you know, they obviously have a desire to work together to try to get these issues resolved when they arise. But that's not always possible, or not all registrars are as cooperative, or responsive, and so this provides a path for resolution of those kinds of transfer issues if cooperation between registrars doesn't work.
And one other thing I could add that's not related to that comment, the registries are required to report these statistics in their monthly reports to ICANN, so you can actually go online in the transaction report that registries file, and there's a column that the number of disputes won, you know, lost by registrar. To be honest, I haven't looked at any other registries. I just know ours are zero every month.
Barry, you have another question?
Yeah, just real quick. I'm sorry. And out of the ones that have been that we've exercised before, whether it be level one, level two, you know, who's the primary initiator to this process? Is it a registrant, or are registrars taking it upon themselves based on a abuse they saw and trying to correct it themselves? Thank you.
I can't really answer that because we haven't seen any, but I'm guessing it's a combination, but certainly I'm sure there are registrants who complain. And
yeah, this is James. I think that it's used as a tool to resolve a dispute that's raised initially by a registrant. I don't know that we would go to this unilaterally first. You know, it usually has to start somewhere with a registrant complaint. Whether they know that this process exists or they're familiar with all the requirements and steps that it involves, you know, it starts with them raising the issue with the registrar.
Mary, you had a follow-up question?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm lowering my hand. Thank you.
Any other questions on this? Okay, well, thanks for the explanation. We'll see if we can get the slides, because the last one, the timeline workflow one, is impossible to decipher.
Yeah.
I have the slides, so I'll post them on the wiki if Eric doesn't mind.
No, that's fine.
Okay.
Okay, the next item on the agenda we had was an exchange of views on potential changes to TDRP that might address issues whether... Oh, God, I'm trying to read this. A process for urgent return resolution of a domain name should be developed. But James has his hand up.
Did you like that? yeah, just as an overview and to maybe kick off the discussion in this area is that the TDRP, at least internally, is perceived to be slow in practice, somewhat expensive and involved in terms of, if not actual fees paid, the number of resources that have to be engaged to execute it. And the outcomes or potential outcomes of a TDP are not necessarily consistent in practice. So I think that, you know, those are three areas that we can take a look at when there's a transfer dispute. It's usually a matter that is very time sensitive, and that's one of the reasons why I think that you see a lot of these relationships between registrar services teams, where they will call and contact one another as opposed to escalating it to the registry, because they know that essentially that by that time it's going to be too late. So I just wanted to kick off the discussion with the idea that it is slow, it is expensive, and it is not necessarily predictable in its outputs.
Do we have any idea of the timelines that are generally involved?
Actually, I don't. I probably should have longer than one phone call, which can be the case in the expedited method.
Chris Chaplow, you're on Adobe Connect. Want to jump in?
Hello there. Yes, I was just wondering whether there's a place where all the results of the TDRPs are logged, you know, a little bit like the WIPO website for the UDRPs, that we could actually look and see some of the panel's reviews.
I'm not aware of any, this is Stacey Burnett from ICANN. I'm not aware of any place where decisions are posted concerning this dispute resolution process.
Okay,
thank you.
James has just got up, but I think I'll annoy Tim with this. Tim, do you have any idea of the kind of average length of some of these disputes that you've dealt with? Or any idea kind of anecdotally about the length that a dispute might take to be resolved?
Through the dispute resolution process? I can tell you that we try to solve most of these issues. In fact, I'm not sure we've ever filed a dispute ourselves. Now, we've had disputes filed against us when we weren't able to work things out with the registrar. And in those cases, we usually almost always let that run its process, the registry make a decision, and then we comply with whatever that is. So I would imagine in that case it probably runs pretty much the full length of the resolution process timeline.
Which would be roughly at what time?
What is it? Maybe a month, okay. Something roughly in that neighborhood.
Okay. I was just trying to get an idea of the kind of times we're dealing with, whether we're talking about a day, a week, a month, 6 months, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's certainly the dispute resolution certainly isn't. It wasn't meant to be, you know, a quick resolution to a hijacking or something of that nature. I think those sort of issues we're discussing elsewhere, but it certainly wasn't meant to be that.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else want to jump in here?
It's just looking at the timeline. On a level one dispute, it would be at least 26 days and another 14 days if an appeal is filed. Because one question I had, and actually I just asked Margie, but maybe someone else knows, because if we're looking at this process or procedure to see whether there could be a way to introduce some kind of fast-track mechanism for really urgent cases, I was wondering if in any other dispute resolution processes, like, I don't know, UDRP or any other kind of others, whether something like that exists that we could look at as a model or an example of how to develop something like that.
Yeah, I think that'd be good to look at. I'm not sure, America, if something like that exists. I think the one concern, though, that is repeated often by registrars and probably registries as well, and the reason for some, you know, the length of the dispute process is just making sure we do our due diligence so that we don't create risk for ourselves later. So as we shorten that process or get into things that are meant to be quick resolutions, that issue needs to be covered somehow, so that we don't, you know, end up causing a litigation issue for everybody that's involved.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to comment that the UDRP does not have any expedited procedure. There's no, you know, quick resolution there.
What's the average length of a UDRP?
What, about 6 weeks? It's about 6 weeks.
Marika, right?
So I guess that does bring us back then to the question, you know, is there a way to develop a process for urgent return while taking into account due diligence? And I'm wondering indeed if everyone says, well, this is the time it probably takes to do due diligence. Would there be any way that, you know, this group can come up with a process for urgent return?
James?
Well, I think that's an excellent point. And I just wanted to maybe feed the discussion with the idea that, and it's somewhat of an abstract concept, but if you're goal of any expedited or urgent return or expedited TDRP is to put things back the way they were prior to some event, a transfer or a dispute. I think that there perhaps could be made the case that there's less risk involved in putting something back the way it was as opposed to changing the situation before the disputed transfer occurred. Just a thought.
Pretty good.
Yeah, because the question I have, in this process, I presume nothing is frozen or turned back. You know, the transfer is made and then the dispute process starts, but anything only gets changed at the end of it. There's no going back to original state, then looking at the evidence and information, and then deciding whether.
I think that's correct. Yeah.
Tim, did you want to jump in there?
Just a thought that we can discuss more later, but I'm just curious as to, you know, the quick resolution, if that would cross over or tie in somehow with the work being done on malicious conduct, because it seemed to be similar, you know, the kinds of things that may need to be looked at or considered when, taking down a site quickly or trying to resolve a hijacking case, perhaps. Now, maybe we'd find that isn't true, but I think that would be another process that's going on that we should probably keep tabs on to see what, if any, crossover there might be.
There's been discussions about that, specifically with respect to the URS, the Uniform Rapid Suspension Procedure, with respect to trademarks. And one of the things that they've tried to build in is that you leave the website alone while all this is happening. So, I'm not aware of that in the malicious conduct side, but certainly on the trademark side, that was one of the considerations that they had when they developed the report.
Do you mean by leave it alone in what respect?
The original website continues to resolve while the procedure goes on. I don't know if that's even possible when you do a transfer, but in the world of the trademark dispute, that's what they were talking about.
Thank you, Martin. That's an evidentiary interest that comes out of the trademark protection interest area, as opposed to a correctness of transfer interest, which is the inter-registrar issue and the registry issue. Okay, so we have those two interests to attempt to reconcile. Thank you.
Right. I think you had a question to follow up on.
I didn't quite follow that at all. That completely confused me.
I believe Margie's making the case that there's an evidentiary interest in transfers, which is external to the registrar interest in the transfer or the registry's interest in the transfer. And we need to decide which of those two interests is the controlling interest.
I guess I think what I'm saying is it's a protection of registrant, right? So if there's an erroneous transfer, where's the presumption? Is the presumption that the original registrant's website is the more appropriate one? I mean, you're right. That is, there's some assumption there.
James?
Just another thought on this subject, that if we're looking at ways or examining means to improve this particular process, we should also guard against inadvertently creating a UDRP light type of a process where someone realizes that by staking a claim via a questionable transfer request against a domain that where the control of that registration is in dispute to kick off some other expedited process, I think that's something that should be guarded against as well. That this could expand beyond transfers and just get into disputes in general.
Thanks. Anybody else want to jump in there?
I'll just add one more comment in general, which isn't addressed in the policy so much, but there was actually an operational impact to all of this in reversing transfers because of, the policy, one policy that states you can't have a subsequent transfer after a transfer for 60 days. So there were operational development impacts for registries and maybe some registrars as well to develop the mechanisms to reverse a transfer as a result of a decision or even just an agreement between two registrars. And most registries at the time have developed processes for reversing transfers without adding a year or charging the registrar again for the transfer. And I can't really speak as to how every registry has done that, but they've all had to develop some process for that.
Tim?
Yeah, I guess what the exchange between Margie and Eric just kind of, I don't know, fermented in my head for a minute, and raised an idea that it's just, again, off the shooting from the hip, sort of, so to speak, but it'd be interesting to see what others think about it or if it's been considered before. But, you know, there's really two issues with a transfer or a hijacking, and that is that the registrant of record, of course, you know, is one concern, the registrar of record, that the whole actual transfer itself. But the resolution of the website is actually the initial problem, right? So once the domain name transfers, it stops resolving. You know, would the quickest way to solve that, or one potential way would be when a dispute is filed, it could be the original name servers or the original resolution of that name could again begin to occur immediately, even while the transfer dispute process is ongoing to decide whether the transfer is good or bad. Because it seems that would be, at least in my mind, just thinking of it initially, it's the least amount of harm. That's where the name was resolving originally. The new owner or registrant, you know, had no stake yet. So really, there would be minimal harm in keeping them from controlling the name. But having it resolved would solve the immediate issue that might be presented. So just a thought.
Thanks, Tim. Any other thoughts on this at the moment? I can see Graham is thinking, pondering. And Marika?
Another question back to Tim. Would your proposal be in the context of the TDRP or separate process, or that's not the obvious choice?
Yeah, I guess I was thinking perhaps in the context of the TDRP. It would provide another opportunity of use for it. I mean, I think when a hijacking occurs, the process that is undertaking there to determine whether the name needs to be returned or not, it seems like we have a lot of that in place there. The main issue is how do we solve the immediate problem of getting that domain to resolve back to its original website. So just adding that to the TDRP might be the way to resolve it.
I mean, one thing I would add as well is that, you know, using the term website is a bit inaccurate. But, I mean, a lot of domains don't have websites and have no reason to have websites. I can see somebody about to jump in.
Yeah, my only thought would be, I guess the wrinkle that I'd add is that sometimes there might be harm, but in the large majority of cases, if I'm actually buying it and then something goes bad on the deal, and then the person disputes it at the end of the day, because that's the only scenario I can kind of see these in. You agree to an arrangement, you transfer the website, then you don't actually get the money that you're looking for, and then you're dealing with that as, you know, that as the result of the bad deal, the deal gone bad. And I think the balance of harm in that, even though there, you know, I think that there's harm to be had on that other side of doing that switchback, I think you're going to run into the vast majority of cases that have greater harm produced by leaving it at the new registrar than the other way around.
Thanks. Go ahead.
In the example that you've described, you've got two issues going on, though. You're having a registrar transfer and a registrant change as well. So it's a little more complicated than the scenario you're talking about, because the typical transfer that we're talking about here is the registrant is the same and you're merely switching from one registrar to another registrar.
Actually, I'm not too sure that that's entirely true. I mean, within this working group, we, unless my memory is failing me, which at this time in the morning is quite likely, I don't think we ever discussed whether there was a change of registrant or not. We were talking about transfers in general, regardless of registrant changes.
Okay, but this policy doesn't deal with registrant transfer, correct? This policy deals with registrar transfer. So at least that's my recollection for the way this policy was developed. The hijacking issue that, you know, maybe need to be dealt with differently, but I don't think this policy necessarily helps, or we need to change it to address that situation.
Which I think is part of what we're discussing.
I think, and Margie, please correct me, but I'm not aware of any policy that explicitly deals with change of registrant. They're all, and then hence that's one of the gray areas we get into.
That's right. I'm not aware of anything either.
Chris, on Adobe Connect.
Yeah, I think we're heading in the right direction here. Notice the actual question is whether the process for urgent return stroke resolution of a domain name. So the word there, resolution, is meaning, isn't it, the resolution of a website or equivalent. And that is the urgency element, isn't it? Because if that doesn't happen, it's just an administrative problem, isn't it?
Olaf?
Yeah, in a bit in the same vein, would it be so that the only cases where this urgency would occur would be when there simultaneously immediately before has been change of registrant, meaning a plain transfer between registrars, no change of registrant. Could it occur in those cases that there is a need for an urgent return when there is no change of registrant?
What if there's a change in DNS?
Yes. That's the answer to the question.
Okay.
However that occurs.
Okay. But we can't see if there's been, we can see a change in the name servers, we can see a change in the registrant. But if the name servers aren't changed, yet the records are changed, there's no easy way for us to see that. Okay. Marika?
So I guess we're coming back then to the question of, like, how would we identify whether it's a hijacking or not? You would file under this rapid procedure, who decides or how can you make the claim of this is a hijacking, so it should be returned to the original name servers, or this is, you know, an ordinary dispute and no need to return to the original name servers but go through the process.
Tim?
Yeah, maybe not. I mean, if you think, I guess I would like to or just recommend that we explore, you know, that possibility that in when any dispute's filed, those name servers are put back. That would just be an automatic step of a dispute resolution. Now, we may find that that doesn't make sense or there's other issues with that, but I think it's worth looking at, again, with the idea that the new owner, however you want to put it, of the domain name would have less stake in what's going on or have less harm done.
Seems logical to me. Anybody else have any thoughts on the name server issue? Helen?
I'm just wondering if it's the dispute is still going on, why would you put the name servers back? Wouldn't you just put the domain on hold while the dispute is going on? Because you don't know who's right and who's wrong yet.
But is that the root of least harm? If you have a potential, if you have a dispute between two entities, we won't say registrants because I think that's going to confuse matters, but two entities. One entity says it claims that they are the rightful registrant, the other entity claims that they're the rightful registrant. You were trying to resolve that dispute. One of the parties is obviously wrong and one of the parties may be right. So in some cases it's not going to be that clear cut. If you put the domain on hold, then everybody loses.
That's true, but if the other one is alleging harm is being done, then by putting it back to the original one, the harm continues.
But hold on, we're talking about a transfer. So if harm is being done by not allowing the transfer, then that's a different type of dispute, surely.
Right.
Which is outside this policy.
But it's the case of the DNS servers that may be affecting. If the dispute as to who owns it and who has control and who should have the DNS, if it can't be resolved easily, then by putting the domain on hold, at least nobody's controlling anybody else until it's sorted.
Okay. Graeme?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I see the point on that, just as to follow along, not necessarily that I agree with the argument, but I guess the argument is, hey, you know, we need to put this thing in escrow, right? There's no, let's not make, because you're essentially making the decision before you do any of the due diligence that's required to arrive at the decision. And so you're, I guess the third thing you could either, the choices are leave it with the place where it's been transferred to, return it to the original status, or put it in some holding page that says this, you know, with some static page that says this domain is under this domain is under dispute, and you know that is a third option. Why not?
You're presuming that you know what the A record is, and that there is an A record which resolves to a website where you can display a message.
Well, I'm assuming you could put it there. I mean,
but nobody's going to see it. I have one domain, for example, that has 800 odd users, but if you go to the standard A record or the www record, all you see is a parking page, and you think, oh, that domain's parked. No, it's not. I've got over 800 active users on it because I use an odd subdomain.
Well, then I guess the question would be, could you do anything that would present that message in whatever form? And you're saying that there's no possible way to do that?
Not unless you rewrite the entire DNS system.
Well, I can't imagine that's the case. But
well, okay. I have my name servers. Dyn Inc. has its name servers.
Yep.
Are you going to allow me to do an AXFR?
The point is that I've got to imagine that there's a way.
No, but it's a technical issue. In that, unless you allow an AXFR between your name server and my name server, I've no way of knowing what records existed for that domain or which ones were being used. So the only sane option that I can see from a technical perspective is you switch it back to the name servers that were in place originally. Because otherwise it's just not going to work.
Okay.
That's just from a technical perspective.
Okay.
Go ahead, Marty. Oh, sorry, Helen.
What I actually meant was a registry hold. So the DNS will show, but you put it on a registry hold so it's locked. And the domain simply does not come up until the dispute is sorted.
Okay. But that still would harm the registrant.
It would harm the initial one, but not the disputing side. If there's a dispute between the ownership of the domain and one of them is saying that they're being harmed by this person who's hijacked it, then by putting it on registrant hold, they're no longer being harmed, but you're not changing the DNS record, so you've still got the record. All you've done is put it on hold so nothing comes up. But you're putting it on registry hold.
So you're suggesting that the website doesn't resolve for 15 days? The website, or the domain name, if it is ISP or some business, they can't have any...
In a case of a dispute, you may want to decide what level of the dispute that you're going on. So maybe the first level, you keep it at the original one. But if there's a dispute going on and the other registrant is saying this is doing harm to me to have that site up, and they have no right to it, but you're still allowing them to continue to control the first party to continue to control the domain.
I mean, no disrespect, Helen, but I think you... I understand what you're talking about, but I think the problem here is that we're talking about a situation, say, I register a domain with .alliance, and I'm happy, and I love giving you loads of money every year, and it's wonderful, and, you know, my domain's there, and it's doing whatever it is. And then, for some reason, I wake up one morning, and I discover that the domain is no longer with .alliance, it's now with Network Solutions, for example. And that maybe the registrant has changed at the same time, according to who is. That means that the services that I had based on that around that domain name are no longer functioning. So the only way that those services can function again is if you reverse the DNS records back to the resolved to the name service that I was using originally. Do you agree?
Yes, I can see that. But that's if we document that you're actually correct that this happened. If you are disputing somebody else's domain.
No, but it's my domain. I'm the one. The domain was with Registrar A. It is moved to Registrar B. Registrar A, in this case Dot Alliance, initiates some form of dispute regarding domain. So we know it was originally with Registrar A.
So basically we would have to ask Newstar to very kindly change the DNS bot during the dispute back to what it was. Okay.
James, you had your hand up?
Yes, and the more I think about this, the more I'm not sure where I'm going with it, but just as a thought. We want to make sure that whatever directions we're going off in, whether we make any improvements or changes at all, modifications, is that this type of a tool is not used to compel a registrar to accept a transfer that it believes is against its best interests. For example, if it were a known spammer or criminal looking to transfer a large number of registrations, and that registrar were to cancel them, refund them, and things like that, that we wouldn't want that to then turn into a transfer dispute. I think we need to ensure that, and again, this is where I'm kind of waffling a little bit, because the registration agreement should protect you in there, but we shouldn't have to let the internal abuse procedures of that registrar run their course because they were compelled to accept a transfer that they felt or had identified was going to be a problem and they didn't want any part of it. So just a thought here as to another way that this could possibly have some unintended consequences.
Thank you. Marika?
Yeah, now just one point I wanted to make is that you know, if we indeed start looking at the TDRP, it might be worth taking into consideration that there are some further questions related to TDRP down the line in future IRTP PDPs. So at some stage, the group might want to ask a question. If we're looking at this and if we are going down the path of potentially making recommendations, we might look at those other questions as well to see how they tie in. For example, one of the questions is, should a registrant have the possibility to initiate a TDRP? So would that affect our decision on, you know, developing, for example, or proposing a fast-track solution, or having it indeed any dispute, putting it back to the original name server. So it's just something I would like to put on the table.
Thank you. James, any more thoughts on that?
Okay. No, I'm done thinking. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you. The discussion of A records seems to me over-specific. We should be mentioning RRSF rather than A record, since there's more to a domain than merely resolution of an A record. The case that you just mentioned of a registrar attempting to refuse the an unsolicited bulk transfer in, I think that's an interesting problem, or an interesting case that hadn't been thought of, if I understood you correctly, James. This discussion has really made me think about panics and what it would have looked like if we had used the solution that Helen had proposed for when panics was transferred without its knowledge or consent in the middle of the night from one registrar to another, taking down the oldest ISP in New York City. But what I really am concerned about is where we actually started off, Marjorie, which is how we become aware, how the process of the intra-registrar dispute resolution becomes aware of any other process or any other claim of right to evidence, or to how two processes become informed of each other or the existence of each other, rather than opening up the door of the intra-registrar transfer process to registrants, which is another way of signaling between one kind of claim and another kind of claim. Thank you.
So your question is how those two policies might work together or against each other? I don't understand your question.
How do we become informed? That is, how does the intra-registrar transfer process be informed of a pre-existing or a dispute that pre-exists using a different process, or a process, a dispute that arises, again, externally after the initiation of the transfer dispute resolution protocol process? So I'm concerned about where we learn that something else is going on, and then trying to figure out if we can reconcile the two interests.
Are you talking about a specific policy, like whether the policy exists or is being developed?
We have this process for resolution of interest or competing claims between registrars, and you brought the interests of registrants into this as well, and presumably they have other processes external to this, the one we're discussing presently. So how do these processes become informed so that we can attempt to reconcile their claims?
The problem is that the policy is not developed yet. That's what we're talking about this week in the possibly adopting trademark protections in the new GTLD program. So there's nothing currently out there that I'm aware of with respect to the, expedited takedowns for trademark abuse. So, ideally, to answer your question, if it was adopted, then we would look at it and see how the two policies that overlap. But it's being developed, and it, in any event, would only apply to new GTLDs, not existing GTLDs.
Right. I've used this word with some reluctance, but I'm concerned is the hijacking of the registrar process by a registrant process. That is, we have a dispute resolution process for conflicting claims between registrars, and there are no registrants in that picture. And to allow the covert signaling of registrant interests in some other process by extending the registrar process to registrants is one solution, but are there others?
I mean, just to clarify, I mean, it's not a proposal to open up this process to registrants. It's one of the questions that was asked in the context of the IRTP review overall. So it's like one of the questions that comes up in PDP B-D. So it's not a proposal that's on the table. It's just one of the questions that has been raised in that context, for a working group to consider whether that should be... it should be opened up, and I guess you're making the case that maybe that's not such a good idea because it might conflict the things and make things confusing, if I understand correctly.
Well, we're discussing our policy-making choices, and I wanted to make it clear that adding the registrants into the policy process here is one possible mechanism for communicating between two sets of interests and two sets of processes. And we have other choices.
James?
Yeah, and just very quickly, Marika, as a question, was there a specific reasoning why we didn't include or consolidate all of the TDRP-related questions and issues into this particular working group, and is it too late to do that now if we could go through our council liaison to go and pick those up?
Well, they were all grouped together in PDPD, and I think this question wasn't, the hijacking question wasn't originally seen as related to the TDRP, but because this group started discussing maybe we should look at TDRP as a mechanism to address that question, that's why it came up. And I think as well, if we're going down that line, I think it might make sense to maybe look at those questions and see whether it's feasible to incorporate them in these groups, because they're like, I think there are four different questions that are in that specific category, and not all of them are very small questions, but the group might want to look which ones are closely related and then work through Tim to bring that to the council and see whether any changes should be made to the charter.
Tim?
Yeah, no, actually I think that's fair. One thing I'd be concerned about, because we've had it happen once, maybe twice already, where we, one, the TDRP, PDP sort of push things off. They did make a decision. It was recommended that things be moved into different PDPs. I think that may make sense sometimes, but I would just want to be cautious about doing that too often. So I think that's fair to bring those questions in if we're going to look at it, to see if those are things we could perhaps even address here before we just try to push it off into the next PDP.
Any other questions or comments while Kayla gets the drinks?
Sorry about that. My voice is gone completely. Okay, I think we should move on to the next item on the agenda, which is... the public comment period. We're reviewing the comments that we've received so far. And also, as a side note, the business constituency has promised me faithfully that they are working on providing us with feedback, though they didn't give us a fixed timeline on when they would do so. For those of you following on the Adobe Connect, sorry, Barry Cobb has a question. Barry?
Yes, I'd just like to say that I have been discussing with some other members in the VC about trying to get our position statement generated. But I don't definitely have a date as of yet.
Okay, thank you. Marika has put up a matrix type thing, which I think she can now explain to us in detail.
So on the Adobe Connect, apologies, but I haven't posted it yet on the wiki, but on the Adobe Connect you'll see an Excel sheet, a matrix, in which I've tried to categorize the different comments received during the initial public comment period as a way to facilitate the review by the working group of the different comments. I just want to point out, you know, that these are just, you know, it's just a matrix, so it's very short, so I only managed to include a few words on those comments, so I would highly recommend everyone to review the comments in full detail to really understand what the commenter, the point the commenter tried to make. Another question, and something that happened as well in another working group where some of you are also participating, as part of this public comment period, the registrar constituency also submitted its comments. So the question is, they have been integrated here now, but the group might prefer to look at all the constituency statements at the same time. So the question is, would you like me just to take those out here and consider them together with the comments from the other constituencies, stakeholder groups, or we leave them in here as they were received as part of the public comment period?
Personally, I'm just happy that somebody's submitted some comments, but I don't have any opinion either way. James?
I think I don't really have any strong opinion. I think whatever is more expeditious for you, Marika, and if there's a way to categorize them in with the general public comments, that's fine.
Because the other question would be, we have already received statements as well from the registry constituency and the IPC constituency, so I guess the other question would be, does it make sense then to integrate those here as well, so we have all comments received to date into one overview that the group can work through?
Well, then I would submit that when we treat all stakeholder groups or constituencies the same, so what we do for one, we do for all, and if they're going to be separated out or kept in their own category, then we should probably do the same with them. Am I making more work by I'm trying to understand the implications of the question.
No, it's. I guess it's partly a question that, you know, comes back to a discussion we had the other day. You know, do constituency statements, stakeholder group statements, do they have a different weight compared to individual comments? So, would the group like to review them separately? As a way to say, look, we know that, for example, you know, in the registry constituency, there's a stakeholder group, there's a large number of people that have supported the statement. Does it give more weight to their opinion? No.
Well, and I guess, and it's less a concern about the, and I think it was Paul Diaz and I worked with Clark Walton to develop the registrar stakeholder group's constituency statement, and, you know, have no qualms about including that with the general general comments, but want to be sure that it's not... given precedence to other constituency statements.
So the answer to the question is yes, no, maybe, perhaps.
The answer is whatever is easiest for Marika, but I think what is done for one should be done for all.
Okay.
Just to keep it uniform.
Tim.
Yeah, I'm trying to think what ends up, what, you know, the structure of a final report and how that might affect that, if the constituency statements need to be, you know, individually referred to a reference, then it might make sense to keep them separate, just to save work down the road when with the final report. Be the only other thought I had.
I think that's a very good point, because normally we do, they come normally, I think, up in the same chapter, but we do separate them out, and they are given a different weight in that sense. So I would agree in taking them all together, all the constituency stakeholder group statements, into one overview, and then the public comments in a separate one. So maybe for this discussion, we can just ignore for now the registrar constituency statements and review them in the context of the others that we see.
Okay. Seems reasonable.
So I've categorized the different comments received under the different charter questions that we put out for public comment, and then there's as well a category of general comments or other issues raised for consideration that didn't fit any of the categories at first sight. So looking at the first comment here, it's a comment made and asking a question that I think we've asked ourselves as well a number of times. Basically asking, does the incidence of hijacking warrant the development of a new procedure? Basically going to back to, you know, the time and effort and resources involved in developing and implementing a new policy. You know, is that warranted if this only happens, you know, once, twice a year, or even less?
James wants to jump in.
Yeah, this is more of an overarching question. As I'm looking at the agenda and where we are, and I'm looking at the clock and where we are, and I'm concerned that we might run into a situation where we're going to cut short the open part of the meeting. So I just want to make sure that is our intention to go through the public comments now individually, or and do we have time?
I suppose let's do this the simple way. Is there anybody here who isn't part of the working group who would like to give us some input, some thoughts, some random suggestions, ideas, reflections? Okay, so since we're still here and nobody wants to jump in, we can have a look at a couple of the questions. Move forward. James, you still have your hand up? Okay. So, how many comments did we receive? Total. Okay, so out of the public comment period, we only received 7 actual comments. Exactly a gigantic number. And 3 were considered to be unrelated to what we were looking at. So we only had 4 comments that we could actually do any work with.
But I have subdivided them because many provided input on the different ones. The list is longer than 4.
Okay, we just had a look at, say, the first question. Does incidents of hijacking warrant development of a new procedure? What was the feedback on that?
That was the comment made. The person basically said, well, you know, is there a need to develop a new procedure if, you know, if this doesn't happen that often? You know, if I can, you know, provide my input, of course, on the other side, you can say, for the person or the company organization that it does happen, I'm sure they would be very happy if there would be some kind of procedure to have an urgent resolution.
So we are running a bit short on time here, so we're going to take detail might not work.
Well, but we don't necessarily need to finish this. I mean, we can continue at the next meeting. I mean, our people prefer to they'll do this now and, you know, take an early stop and get ready for the opening ceremony. We can as well start this at the next meeting.
Might work a bit better. When is our next meeting, do you say? 2 weeks.
I think that's what we
actually agreed on.
Yeah. And I think we said as well we would do it in 2 weeks and then immediately the week after that as well, as otherwise we would run into conflict with the ALEC XCOM meeting.
Okay. Maybe we should just call it a day. Yes, James?
You knew I wasn't going to let you off that easy. So
I know.
When you say 2 weeks, you mean November 10th. Is that correct? Thank you.
Does anybody have any other further input they'd like to make at this time? Or should we wrap this up? Sorry? Work away.
As long as you send it to us so we can post it on the wiki.
Okay, well, thanks, everybody. Thanks, Marika, for your assistance as ever, and thanks to ICANN staff. And we'll follow up on this at the next meeting on November 10th. Correct? Yeah, November 10th. Okay, thank you.